Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Anna Mateo, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Two major college football conferences recently canceled their fall seasons because of concerns over the new coronavirus. The Big Ten and Pac-12 athletic conferences announced they would not have a fall football season and would also postpone other sports. College football is a tradition in America and has millions of fans across the country. The two powerful conferences have valuable agreements to play games shown on television. The move comes 5 months after the spread of coronavirus cases in the U.S. led to the cancellation of the men's and women's NCAA basketball tournaments. Other winter sports also had their seasons cut short, and spring sports were canceled. Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott said of canceling the conference's football season, "This was an extremely difficult and painful decision that we know will have important impacts on our student athletes, coaches, administrators, and our fans. Players, coaches, and even U.S. President Donald Trump have asked that the season be held in some way. However, 40% of major college football teams have now decided to cancel the fall season. The Big Ten and the Pac-12 conferences say the risk of trying to keep players from getting infected with and spreading the virus is too high. Every life is critical, Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren told the AP. The Southeastern Conference and Atlantic Coast Conference are two other big college athletic groups. Both had expressed hopefulness about the fall season. Another conference, the Big 12, has still not released new plans. Together, the five athletic conferences are considered the biggest in the sport. It is unclear what they will do next. Smaller athletic conferences also have difficult decisions to make. The American Athletic Conference, Conference USA, and Sunbelt Conference have not yet decided what to do about the fall sports season. The Mid-American and Mountain West conferences have suggested they may play football in the spring of 2021. Everyone is going to make their independent decisions, and I certainly respect our colleagues, the Pac-12's Scott said. The Big Ten said it was postponing all fall sports and hoping to make them up in the second semester. The Pac-12 said all sports would be postponed until January 1st including basketball. Many college football players around the country were shocked by the cancellations. Many had recently taken to social media with the hashtag #WeWantToPlay. The move comes as some college players and activists have called on colleges to provide greater health and safety protections for players. They also call on colleges to directly pay student athletes and permit a players' association. Some of these demands have been announced by the group #WeAreUnited. There had been hopes that the fall season could be played with fewer games and less travel. 1 week ago, the Big Ten had released an updated schedule involving only teams within the conference. The Big Ten includes schools like the Ohio State University, the University of Michigan, the University of Nebraska, and Penn State University. But the schools were not completely in agreement. Ohio State Athletic Director Gene Smith said he would have liked to have pushed back the season start from September 5th to early October. Nebraska's president wrote that his school was very disappointed in the conference's decision. Nebraska coach Scott Frost and Ohio State coach Ryan Day both suggested that if the Big Ten did not play, their schools might look for games with other teams. In the Pac-12, which includes schools like the University of Southern California and the University of Oregon, there seemed to be more agreement. "We feel good about our decision," Oregon President Michael Schill said. "We would have made this decision independent of the Big Ten. We respect the institutions in the Big Ten. Many of them have the same values we have. We're pleased they are joining us." I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Marriage ceremonies, or weddings, are among the most important events in the lives of many people. The COVID-19 health crisis has severely affected weddings and damaged the multi-billion-dollar industry that supports them. Because of the virus, many couples in the United States and around the world have had to postpone the big day, another way of saying wedding.
But now that some areas have eased rules on public gatherings, plenty of couples are ready to say, "I do." However, they may need to wear a face mask when they say it. And that has led to some problems. Many couples are not willing to have a pandemic-looking wedding party, so they are not willing to follow restrictions on large gatherings, like wearing face masks, limiting the number of guests, and social distancing.
In early July, Reuters also reported that wedding venues in Turkey had reopened, but with restrictions. Guests' temperatures were taken upon arrival. Tables had to be separated. And everyone, including the bride and groom, had to wear masks. The marketing research company KPMG says that families in India spend an estimated $50 billion on weddings every year. The market in the U.S. is also huge, worth more than $72 billion a year. To make couples happy, some places or venues in the U.S. are not following coronavirus safety restrictions. And this may be putting wedding industry workers at risk.
Wedding planners, photographers, and musicians are just some of the people who earn money from wedding parties and related events. The pandemic quickly put a stop to their earnings. So now, as more couples are getting married, those employed in the wedding industry have little choice but to work. Recently, some have begun sharing stories of health risks. One of them is Susan Stripling, a photographer from New York. She reported recently that some venues are not following guidelines on masks or limiting the number of wedding guests.
In Chicago, photographer Cherry Schrader told the Associated Press she felt tricked. Before taking a wedding job, Schrader had been told that all safety guidelines would be followed. Yet when she showed up for a July wedding, she found 165 unmasked people indoors and no signs of social distancing. "It looked like a normal wedding pre-COVID," she said.
Alexis Alvarez of Chicago works as a wedding planner. She said her bridal parties have reduced the number of guests to help with social distancing. They are also asking guests to wear masks. She told the AP, "The reality is, guests that don't feel safe attending events aren't going to." Alvarez uses other safety measures at her weddings. Tables are spaced farther apart than usual. When possible, people are grouped by family. To avoid crowd issues, she advises some couples to hold separate celebrations with smaller groups of people at different times.
Some couples argue that face masks will ruin the memories of their big day. Other couples are giving guests the choice to wear or not to wear a face mask. Still others are wearing beautiful face masks that match the wedding gown. In Turkey, Birdecek Kadzita, a bridal gown designer, makes beautiful masks for the brides. "Brides are already feeling sad, and they have no excitement," she told Reuters. "So we tried to make something to cheer them up."
Wedding planner Lynn Goldberg is organizing a December wedding party for 200 guests. The venue will be the home of the bride's parents in upstate New York. Goldberg says the couple and their families do not want the pandemic to affect their wedding plans. So there will be no face masks and no social distance warnings at the wedding. Planning a wedding for 200 guests while social distancing is difficult, Goldberg said, but doable. But asking 200 guests to not wear masks, she added, is crazy.
Alexis Alvarez said she understands that face masks in photos and videos may ruin the look for many couples. "The big question everyone needs to be answering right now," she said, "is what's the moral responsibility? Weddings causing COVID-19 outbreaks remain rare, but they do happen. Back in early June, Reuters reported that a wedding party in Iran likely caused an increase in coronavirus infections. President Hassan Rouhani made this claim on state television. The story explained.
Reuters reported last month that Australia had banned singing, dancing, and mingling at weddings. Health officials did this after an increase in COVID cases were reported.
And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we tell about relations between the American colonies and Britain after the French and Indian War. Here is Steve Ember.
The French and Indian War was one part of a world conflict between Britain and France. It was fought to decide which of the two powerful nations would control North America. The British defeated the French in North America in 1763. As a result, the British took control of lands that had been claimed by France. Britain was now responsible for almost 2 million people in the 13 American colonies and 60,000 French-speaking people in Canada. In addition to political and economic responsibilities, Britain had to protect all these colonists from different groups of Indians. This would cost a lot of money. Britain already had spent a lot sending troops and material to the colonies to fight the French and Indian War. It believed the American colonists should now help pay for that war. The colonists in North America in 1763 were very different from those who had settled there more than 100 years before. They had different ideas. They had come to consider their colonial legislatures as smaller but similar to the British Parliament in London. These smaller parliaments had helped the colonists rule themselves for more than 100 years. The colonists began to feel that their legislatures should also have the powers that the British Parliament had. The situation in England had changed as well. In the year 1707, the nation became officially known as Great Britain. Its king no longer controlled Parliament as he had in the early 1600s. Then the king decided all major questions, especially those concerning the colonies. But power had moved from the king to the Parliament. It was the legislature that decided major questions by the time of the French and Indian War, especially the power to tax. The parliaments in the colonies began to believe that they too should have this power of taxation. The first English settlers in America considered themselves citizens of England. They had made a dangerous trip across the ocean to create a little England in a new place, to trade with the mother country, and to spread their religion. By 1763, however, the colonists thought of themselves as Americans. Many of their families had been in North America for 50 to 100 years. They had cleared the land, built homes, fought Indians, and made lives for themselves far away from Britain. They had different everyday concerns than the people in Britain. Their way of life was different, too. They did not want anyone else to tell them how to govern themselves. The people in Britain, however, still believed that the purpose of a colony was to serve the mother country. The government treated British citizens in the colonies differently from those at home. It demanded special taxes from the colonists. It also ordered them to feed British troops and let them live in their houses. Britain claimed that the soldiers were in the colonies to protect the people. But the people asked, "Protect us from whom?" As long as the French were nearby in Canada, the colonists needed the protection of the British Army and Navy. After the French were gone, following their defeat in the French and Indian War, the colonists felt they no longer needed British military protection. The British government demanded that the colonists pay higher and higher taxes. One reason was that the government wanted to show the colonists that it was in control. Another reason was that Britain was having money problems. Foreign wars had left the country with big debts. The British thought the colonists should help pay some of these debts, especially those resulting from the French and Indian War. The American colonists might have agreed, but they wanted to have a say in the decision. They wanted the right to vote about their own taxes, like the people living in Britain. But no colonists were permitted to serve in the British Parliament, so they protested that they were being taxed without being represented. In 1764, the British Parliament approved the Sugar Act. This legislation set taxes on sugar, coffee, some wines, and other products imported to America in large amounts. It increased the taxes on European products sent to the colonies through Britain. The British government also approved new measures aimed at enforcing all trade laws. And it decided to restrict the production of paper money in the colonies. The American colonists opposed all these new laws. Yet they could not agree about how to resist. Colonial assemblies approved protests against the laws, but the protests were all different and had no real effect. Business groups attempted to organize boycotts of goods, but these were not very successful until the British government approved another tax in 1765, a tax on stamps. The Stamp Act probably angered more American colonists than any earlier tax. Under this law, the colonists had to buy a British stamp for every piece of printed paper they used. That meant they would be taxed for every piece of newspaper, every document, even every playing card. The colonists refused to pay. colonial assemblies approved resolutions suggesting that the British Parliament had no right to tax the colonies at all. Some colonists were so angry that they attacked British stamp agents. Historians say the main reason the colonists were angry was because Britain had rejected the idea of no taxation without representation. Almost no colonist wanted to be independent of Britain at that time, yet all of them valued their rights as British citizens and the idea of local self-rule. They considered the Stamp Act to be the worst in a series of violations of these rights. The American colonists refused to obey the Stamp Act. They also refused to buy British goods. Almost 1,000 store owners signed non-importation agreements. This cost British businessmen so much money that they demanded that the government cancel the Stamp Act. Parliament finally canceled the law in 1766. The colonists immediately ended their ban on British goods. But the same day that Parliament ended the Stamp Act, it approved the Declaratory Act. This was a statement saying the colonies existed to serve Britain, and that Britain could approve any law it wanted. Many American colonists considered this statement to be illegal. Historians say this shows just how separated the colonies had become from Britain. Colonial assemblies were able to approve their own laws, but only with the permission of the British Parliament. The colonists, however, considered the work of their assemblies as their own form of self-rule. Britain canceled the Stamp Act, but did not stop demanding taxes. In 1767, Parliament approved a series of new taxes called the Townshend Acts. These were named after the government official who proposed them. The Townshend Acts set taxes on glass, tea, lead, paints, and paper imported into the colonies. The American colonists rejected the Townshend Acts and started a new boycott of British goods. They also took steps to increase manufacturing in the colonies. By the end of 1769, they had reduced by half the amount of goods imported from Britain. The colonies also began to communicate with each other about their problems. In 1768, the Massachusetts General Court sent a letter to the legislatures of the other colonies. It said the Townshend Acts violated the colonists' natural and constitutional rights. When news of the letter reached London, British officials ordered the colonial governor of Massachusetts to dismiss the legislature. Then they moved 4,000 British troops into Boston, the biggest city in Massachusetts and the biggest city in the American colonies. The people of Boston hated the British soldiers. The soldiers were controlling their streets and living in their houses. This tension led to violence.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.